This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Welcome. This is the Vanity Fair Hour, and I am Susan Durfee. This is our last week with the April issue. The first piece I'll be sharing is a profile of the married musicians Alicia Keys and Kasim Dean, who during the last 10 years have collected and promoted art by Black artists. The Dean's List by Nate Freeman. The music industry power couple Alicia Keys and Kasim Swizz Beatz Dean have helped lead the way for a generation of collectors of Black art. The rest of the world is finally catching up. In early 2015, the musician Kasim Dean, known as Swizz Beatz, went with the artist Kehinde Wiley to see his retrospective, A New Republic, at the Brooklyn Museum. Dean had been churning out hits as a hip-hop producer for more than two decades, propelling singles by the likes of Jay-Z, DMZ, Busta Rhymes, and Beyoncé to global inescapability. But Dean, along with his Grammy-winning superstar wife, Alicia Keys, is also a contemporary art patron who caught the bug well before his peers in the hip-hop game. A lot of people used to make fun of me collecting art. I won't say no names, but they're the biggest names, Dean told me recently. We were so hardcore in music. I was Rough Rider, everybody was more in their street element, and so collecting art, well, he trailed off. Walking through the Wiley Show in 2015, Dean was already itching to move to the next echelon. The loaned works came from institutions all over the country, but also a number of private collectors, a hedge fund executive, a manager at a different hedge fund, the manager of a tech billionaire's family office. Dean realized, reading the wall labels, that he saw, quote, no last names of color, unquote. Wiley and Dean walked in front of Femme Piquée par un Serpent, a 25-foot-long painting of a Black man in bed based on a sculpture in the Musée d'Orsay. Courtesy Sean Kelly, New York, its label read, referring to Wiley's commercial gallery. Such wording is often a super insider way to say, this might just be for sale. Wiley was hesitant at first. While Dean and Keys were globally famous musicians, they had not put in enough time dancing the art world tango of museum donations, gallery dinner schmoozing, gala hobnobbing, and eyebrow-raising purchases that moves burgeoning collectors up the waiting lists. I told him, is this work better off going back into storage or being where we could display your work for the audience that you say is lacking, Dean recalled. He paused and looked at his wife, and Kehinde was like, do you know what? I'm going to do it. 9 years later, Femme Piquée par un Serpent is back at the Brooklyn Museum as part of Giants, art from the Dean collection of Swizz Beatz and Alicia Keys, a show of nearly 100 artworks, about a third of the couple's total holdings, that's up until July. On a weekday in early February, as the Deans were preparing for its opening gala, I spoke with the couple about their collection's first major museum exhibition and the effort that brought it to being. We've done every single piece of the process, all of the layouts and the whole thing, Key said. But the thing that blows our mind the most is that, just like everybody else who's going to walk through these doors, we have never seen this collection hung, ever. As visitors walk into the museum's center pavilion, there's Arthur Jaffa's Big Wheel One, a 7,000-pound sculpture of a tire that rises 17 feet in the air. On one wall is Amy Sherald's Deliverance, a giant triptych that wowed at Hauser & Wirth during Frise London in 2022. There's an enormous three-part painting by Gazozian-repped multi-hyphenate Titus Kaphar that the couple acquired directly from the artist's studio and has never been publicly unveiled. The largest ever work by Miliko Makozi, a 21-panel epic, takes up an entire room of the show. There's also a selection of photographs by Gordon Parks and pieces by a grab bag of some of the most exciting artists currently alive: Henry Taylor, Deanna Lawson, Toyin Wiha Otula, Micheline Thomas, Jordan Castile, Odile Donald Odita, Derek Adams, and so on. And the first works that greet you as you enter are Portraits of the Collectors by Wiley. I mentioned to Keys that I'd never seen them before. "Well, we've never seen them either," she said. "They're still drying. They're still wet," Dean added, "and we're not joking." The Deans have built strong relationships with the artists they collect, allowing them access to primo works that would otherwise be held for the world's greatest collectors. Nicola Vassell, who was the curatorial director of the collection for years and now has her own gallery in Chelsea, attributed their ability to build a world-class collection to, quote, "the trust and love that the artists have for them," unquote. Say you have a group of 3-4 amazing collectors who could get a work, Vassell said. Sometime what shifts the balance is the artist, who they hope will own the work, and the context in which the work will live. The Deans also were collecting Black artists, especially Black figurative artists, at a time when the art market has started to correct for decades of neglect. Dean was particularly struck by the contrast he saw between visits to the homes of old guard collectors and his peers. It further fueled their collecting. The couple put many of their largest scale works on view at their homes, including a $20 million mansion in La Jolla, California, that is said to have inspired Tony Stark's house in Iron Man 3. And they have never sold a work since the inception of the collection. You have a Bearden, you have a Basquiat, you have this, you have that. You had Ernie Barnes, you had Gordon Parks, Dean told me. Then I go to my friend's house. They didn't have none of these. In 2019, Dean and Keys made the Art News Top 200 Collectors list, the definitive ranking of global art buyers. With it came access to primary market works usually reserved not for the top 200 collectors, but for the top 20. Sources indicated that the waiting list for one of the only 4 large-scale Sherald works at her first show with Hauser & Wirth was enormous, but the gigantic diptych went to the Dean collection. Brooklyn Museum director Ann Pasternak also has a front row seat to the Dean's rise. Shortly after taking the job, she was at the Brooklyn Heights townhouse owned by board vice chair Stephanie Ingracia, where she was introduced to Dean. After just a few minutes of talking, she and Ingracia asked him to join the board. "I will tell you that there were artists and others who were really skeptical, who would dismiss them from the get-go as just celebrities. Like, well, what do they have to offer?" Pasternak said. "They have absolutely proven themselves to be true and blue and absolutely committed to the artist in a way that artists all see now, and they all want to be in this collection." In the years since, the couple opened an artist residency in Arizona called Dreamland and an art and music festival called No Commission that pops up at art fairs like Art Basel Miami Beach. In 2019, they staged a selling group show at UTA Artist Space in LA called Dreamweavers that consisted partly of work consigned directly by artists. And Gordon Parks, selections from the Dean collection, opened at the Ethelbert Cooper Gallery at Harvard. During the COVID-19 lockdown, Pasternak started thinking about putting together a show. They call it the Dean Collection. They imagine it to have its own wing in the museum at some point in the future, she told me. My mind really started to think seriously about doing an exhibition. in part because he and Alicia have used their platforms as artists to celebrate and fight for the rights of other artists with real passion. When the show was announced, there were some grumblings about a major New York institution giving a private collection such cherished real estate. Pasternak dismissed the notion, citing the fact that 30 Americans, a show of work from the collection of Don and Mara Rubel, toured museums for years to great acclaim. In 2019, the Smart Museum at the University of Chicago staged an exhibition of work owned by Pamela J. Joyner and Alfred G. Giffrudia. "Look at the Lauder collection at the Met, right?" she said. Both Keyes and Dean were born in New York and became young phenoms at nearly the same time. In Hell's Kitchen, Keyes' mother would play the records of Billie Holiday and other jazz greats, which led Keyes to a classical music education on the piano, and at 21, more Grammy statuettes than she could hold at once. Keyes racked up several more platinum records in the years since. For the rest of time, you will not attend a Big Apple sporting event without her voice reminding you that New York is a concrete jungle where dreams are made of. Dean grew up in the Bronx with a father who was close with DJ Kool Herc at the birth of hip-hop and two uncles who started the influential crew Rough Riders. After starting to DJ at age 12, Dean began messing around with beats at an Atlanta studio in 1998 and showed DMX the beat that would become Rough Riders' anthem, a harbinger of the kitchen sink percussion meets earwormy sonic idiom he has since deployed. The hits brought houses, and suddenly something needed to go on the walls. Dean grew up seeing street art in the South Bronx, where Keith Haring would put up tags. Keyes, too, recalls having a poster of Gustav Klimt's The Kiss on the wall growing up, and later discovering Ernie Barnes through the sleeve of a Marvin Gaye record. "For those who don't know that, collecting art is a drug," Dean said. "It's a serious drug. And once you get hooked on the drug, just like any drug, it's hard to get off." By the time Dean and Keyes married in 2010, they were completely devoted to collecting living artists in depth, visiting their studios, consulting them on the installation of the work, and hanging out as much as possible. Vassell, who has worked at Dietsch Products and Pace, pointed the couple toward emerging artists who would soon become young stars, including Nathaniel Mary Quinn, Ebony G. Patterson, and Tshabalala Self. Those relationships were on full display at the museum opening night, where the artists had gathered prior to the arrival of the Board of Trustees and other VIPs. Wiley's white-on-white Celine trainers zipped from one end of the room to the other as Dean came out to greet him with a bow, and Keyes emerged from behind a backdrop to yell, "Hola!" at Nick Cave. Castile came in with We Odutula, and as I was chatting with Kafar, he looked ahead and announced, "Oh, the legend just walked in." There was Micheline Thomas. Jaffa came in with Hank Willis Thomas, who was just with Kennedy Yanko and Cheryl. Adams approached Nia Chanel Abney with a bit of a stutter step and embraced a number of the artists. Eventually, Jamil Shabazz showed up to snap pictures of everyone. "This is like my Met Gala," said a Brooklyn Museum employee. After a few minutes, Keyes clapped and told the artists, "Everybody please join us downstairs on the first floor for a toast at 6 on the dot. 5:55, actually." The crowd filtered downstairs. Most openings attract a few hundred museum members and guests. Attendance of the invite-only bash would top 1,200, including the artist Cause, Ford Foundation President Darren Walker, and Art Basel CEO Noah Horowitz. Waiters passed around flutes of Hennessy Paradis for a toast, and Pasternak joined Dean and Keyes on a riser to address the room. She suggested that before the VIP crowds got to the museum, the artists in the show should join their collectors to see it. Only Dean and Keyes and the artists. No curators, no board members, no directors of the museum. Is that fair? She asked. It was deemed fair. Dean walked toward the door to the exhibition with Keyes strolling into the show with Odutola and Castile, the three of them arm in arm. Okay, our second article is a very timely one. This week, the fifth Broadway revival since 1966 of the musical Cabaret opened. With his essay, Once More with Feeling, Michael Riedel explores the history of this enduring theater icon. Once More with Feeling. For nearly 60 years, Cabaret has transfixed and shocked audiences the world over. As Broadway welcomes a new revival starring Eddie Redmayne, Michael Riedel discusses the musical's enduring power with Liza Minnelli, Joel Grey, Sam Mendes, and Keepers of the Flame. As director Rebecca Frecknell was rehearsing a new cast for her hit London revival of Cabaret, the actor, playing Clifford Bradshaw, an American writer living in Berlin during the final days of the Weimar Republic, came on stage carrying that day's newspaper as a prop. As it happened to be Metro, the free London tabloid commuters read on their way to work. The date was February 25th, 2022. When the actor said his line, "We've got to leave Berlin as soon as possible, tomorrow," Frecknell was caught short. She noticed the paper's headline, "Russia invades Ukraine." Cabaret, the groundbreaking 1966 Broadway musical that tackles fascism, anti-Semitism, abortion, World War II, and the events leading up to the Holocaust, had certainly captured the times once again. Back in rehearsals, 4 months later, Frecknell and the cast got word that the Supreme Court had overturned Roe v. Wade. Every time she checks up on Cabaret, quote, "It feels like something else has happened in the world," she told me over coffee in London in September. A month later, as Frecknell was preparing her production of Cabaret for its Broadway premiere, something else did happen. On October 7th, Hamas terrorists infiltrated Israel, killing at least 1,200 people and taking more than 240 hostages. The revival of Cabaret, starring Eddie Redmayne as the creepy yet seductive MC, Gail Rankin as the gin-swilling nightclub singer Sally Bowles, and Bebe Neuwirth as Fraulein Schneider, a landlady struggling to scrape by, opens April 21st at Manhattan's August Wilson Theater. It will do so in the shadow of a pogrom not seen since the Eisengruppen slaughtered thousands of Jews in Eastern Europe, and in the shadow of a war between Israel and Hamas that continues into its fifth month with the killing of thousands of civilians in Gaza. Nearly 60 years after its debut, Cabaret still stings. That is its brilliance and its tragedy. Redmayne has been haunted by Cabaret ever since he played the MC in prep school. "I was staggered by the character," he says, "the lack of definition of it, the enigma of it." He played the part again during his first year at Cambridge at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, where nearly 3,500 shoestring productions jostle for attention each summer. Cabaret, performed in a tiny venue that stank, Redmayne recalls, did well enough that the producers added an extra show. He was leering at the Kit Kat Club girls from 8 p.m. until 10 p.m., and then from 11 p.m. until 2 in the morning. "You'd wake up at midday. You'd barely see sunshine. I just became this gaunt, skeletal figure." His parents came to see him and said, "You need vitamin D." In 2021, Redmayne, by then an Oscar winner for The Theory of Everything and a Tony winner for Red, was playing the MC again, this time in Frecknell's West End production. His dressing room on opening night was full of flowers. There was one bouquet with a card he did not have a chance to open until intermission. It was from Joel Grey, who originated the role on Broadway and won an Oscar for his performance alongside Liza Minnelli in the 1972 movie. He welcomed the young actor, quote, to the family, unquote. Redmayne says, it was an extraordinary moment for me. Cabaret is based on Goodbye to Berlin, the British writer Christopher Isherwood's collection of stories and character studies set in Weimar Germany as the Nazis are clawing their way to power. Isherwood, who went to Berlin for one reason, boys, he wrote in his memoir Christopher and His Kind, lived in a dingy boarding house amid an array of sleazy lodgers who inspired his characters. But aside from a fleeting mention of a host at a seedy nightclub, there is no MC in his vignettes, nor is there an MC in I Am a Camera, John Van Druten's hit 1951 Broadway play adapted from Isherwood's story Sally Bowles from Goodbye to Berlin. The character, one of the most famous in Broadway history, was created by Harold Prince, who produced and directed the original Cabaret. People write about Cabaret all the time, says John Kander, who composed the music and is at 96 the last living member of that creative team. They write about Liza, they write about Joel, and sometimes about us, Kander and lyricist Fred Ebb. None of that really matters. It's all Hal. Everything about this piece, even the variations that happen in different versions of it, is all because of Hal. In 1964, Prince produced his biggest hit, Fiddler on the Roof. In the final scene, Tevye and his family, having survived a pogrom, leave for America. There is sadness, but also hope. And what of the Jews who did not leave? Cabaret would provide the tragic answer. But Hal Prince was after something else. Without hitting the audience over the head, he wanted to create a musical that echoed what was happening in America. Young men being sent to their deaths in Vietnam, racists such as Alabama politician Bull Connor sicking attack dogs on civil rights marchers. In rehearsals, Prince put up Will Counts' iconic photograph of a white student screaming at a black student during the Little Rock crisis of 1957. That's our show, he told the cast. A bold idea he had early on was to juxtapose the lives of Isherwood's lodgers with one of the tawdry nightclubs Isherwood had frequented. In 1951, while stationed as a soldier in Stuttgart, Germany, Prince himself had hung around such a place. Presiding over the third-rate acts was a master of ceremonies, in white makeup and of indeterminate sexuality. He unnerved me, Prince once told me, but I never forgot him. Kander had seen the same kind of character at the opening of a Marlene Dietrich concert in Europe. An overpainted little man waddled out and said, Willkommen, bienvenue, welcome, Kander recalls. The first song Kander and Ebb wrote for the show was called Willkommen. They wrote 60 more songs. Some of them were outrageous, Kander says. We wrote some anti-Semitic songs, of which there were many in Weimar cabarets. We didn't get very far. They did write one song about anti-Semitism, If You Could See Her, the gorilla song, in which the MC dances with his lover, a gorilla in a pink tutu. At the end of the number, he turns to the audience and whispers, If you could see her through my eyes, she wouldn't look Jewish at all. It was, they thought, the most powerful song in the score. The working title of their musical was Welcome to Berlin. But then, a woman who sold blocks of tickets to theater parties told Prince that her Jewish clients would not buy a show with Berlin in the title. Strolling along the beach one day, Joe Masteroff, who was writing the musical's book, thought of two recent hits, Carnival and Camelot. Both started with a C and had three syllables. why not call the show Cabaret? To play the MC, Prince tapped his friend Joel Grey. A nightclub headliner, Grey could not break into Broadway. The theater was very high-minded, he once said. When Prince called him, he was playing a pirate in a third-rate musical in New York's Jones Beach. Hal knew I was dying, Grey recounts over lunch in the West Village where he lives. I wanted to quit the business. At first, he struggled to create the MC, who did not interact with the other characters. He had numbers, but no words, no line, no role, Grey wrote in his memoir, Master of Ceremonies. A polished performer, he had no trouble with the songs, the dances, the antics. But something was missing, he says. Then he remembered a cheap comedian he'd once seen in St. Louis. The comic had told lecherous jokes, gay jokes, sexist jokes, anything to get a laugh. One day in rehearsal, Grey did everything the comedian had done to get the audience crazy. I was all over the girls, squeezing their breasts, touching their bottoms. They were furious. I was horrible. When it was over, I thought, well, this is the end of my career. He disappeared backstage and cried. And then from out of the darkness came Mr. Prince, Grey says. He put his hand on my shoulder and said, Jolie, that's it. Cabaret played its first performance at the Schubert Theater in Boston in the fall of 1966. Grey stopped the show with the opening number Willkommen. The audience wouldn't stop applauding, Grey recalls. I turned to the stage manager and said, should I get changed for the next scene? The musical ran long. It was in three acts, but it got a prolonged standing ovation. As the curtain came down, Richard Seff, an agent who represented Candor and Ebb, ran into Ebb in the aisle. It's wonderful, Seff said. You'll fix the obvious flaws. In the middle of the night, Seff's phone rang. It was Ebb. You hated it, the songwriter screamed. You are of no help at all. Ebb was reeling because he'd learned Prince was going to cut the show down to two acts. Ebb collapsed in his hotel bed, Candor holding one hand, Grey the other. You're not dying, Fred, Candor told him. Hal has not wrecked our show. Cabaret came roaring into New York, fueled by tremendous word of mouth. But there was a problem. Some Jewish groups were furious about If You Could See Her. How could you equate a gorilla with a Jew? They wanted to know, missing the point entirely. They threatened to boycott the show. Prince, his eye on ticket sales, told Ebb to change the line. She wouldn't look Jewish at all. Change it to something less offensive. She isn't a mesquite at all, using the Yiddish word for a homely person. It's difficult to imagine the impact Cabaret had on audiences in 1966. World War II had ended only 21 years before. Many New York theatergoers had fled Europe or fought the Nazis. There were Holocaust survivors in the audience. There were people whose relatives had died in the gas chambers. Grey knew the show's power. Some nights, dancing with the gorilla, he'd whisper, Jewish, instead of mesquite. The audience gasped. Cabaret won 8 Tony Awards in 1967, catapulted Grey to Broadway stardom, and ran for 3 years. Seff sold the movie rights for $1.5 million, a record at the time. Prince, about to begin rehearsals for Stephen Sondheim's Company, was unavailable to direct the movie scheduled for a 1972 release. So the producers hired the director and choreographer Bob Fosse, who needed the job because his previous movie, Sweet Charity, had been a bust. Fosse, who saw Prince as a rival, stamped out much of what Prince had done, including Joel Grey. He wanted Ruth Gordon to play the MC. But Grey was a sensation, and the studio wanted him. It's either me or Joel, Fosse said. When the studio opted for Joel Grey, Fosse backed down. But he resented Grey, and relations between them were icy. A 26-year-old Liza Minnelli, on the way to stardom herself, was cast as Sally Bowles. The handsome Michael York would play the Cliff character, whose name in the movie was changed to Brian Roberts. And supermodel Marissa Berenson, who at the time seemed to be on the cover of Vogue every other month, got the role of a Jewish department store heiress, a character Fosse took from Isherwood's short story, The Landowners. Cabaret was shot on location in Munich and Berlin. The atmosphere was extremely heavy, Berenson recalls. There was this whole Nazi period, and I felt very much the Berlin Wall, that darkness, that fear, all that repression. She adored Fosse, but he kept her off balance. She was playing a young woman traumatized by what was happening around her, by whispering obscene things in my ear. He was shaking me up. Minnelli, costumed by Halston for the film, found Fosse brilliant and incredibly intense, she tells Vanity Fair in a rare interview. He used every part of me, including my scoliosis. One of my great lessons in working with Fosse was never to think that whatever he was asking couldn't be done. If he said do it, you had to figure out how to do it. You didn't think about how much it hurt, you just made it happen. Back in New York, Fosse arranged a private screening of Cabaret for Kander and Ebb. When it was over, they said nothing. We really hated it, Kander admits. Then they went to the opening at the Ziegfeld Theater in New York. The audience loved it. We realized it was a masterpiece, Kander says, laughing. It just wasn't our show. The success of the movie, with its 8 Academy Awards, soon overshadowed the musical. When people thought of Cabaret, they thought of finger snaps and bowler hats. They thought of Fosse and, of course, Minnelli, who would adopt the lyric, "Life is a Cabaret," as her signature. Her Best Actress Oscar became part of a dynasty. Her mother, Judy Garland, and father, director Vincente Minnelli, each had one of their own. Papa was even more excited about the Oscar than I was, she said, and baby, I was, no, I still am, excited. By 1987, in part to burnish Cabaret's theatrical legacy, Prince decided to recreate his original production on Broadway, with Gray once again serving as the MC. But it had the odor of mothballs. The New York Times drama critic Frank Rich wrote that it was not, as Sally Bowles sings, perfectly marvelous, but, quote, it does approach the perfectly mediocre, unquote. Much of the show, he added, was old-fashioned and plodding. In the early 1990s, Sam Mendes, then a young director running a pocket-sized theater in London called the Donmar Warehouse, heard the novelist Martin Amis give a talk. Amis was writing Time's Arrow, about a German doctor who works in a concentration camp. I've already written about the Nazis, and people say to me, why are you doing it again? Amis said. And I said, well, what else is there? At the end of the day, Menzies tells me, the biggest question of the 20th century is, how could this have happened? Mendes decided to stage Cabaret at the Donmar in 1993. Another horror was unfolding at the time. Serb paramilitaries were slaughtering Bosnian Muslims, ethnic cleansing on an unimaginable scale. Mendes hit on a terrific concept for his production. He transformed his theater into a nightclub. The audience sat at little tables with red lamps, and the performers were truly seedy. He told the actors playing the Kit Kat Club girls not to shave their armpits or their legs. Unshaved armpits, it sent shockwaves around the theater, he recalls. Still, there was no room or money for an orchestra, and then the actors played the instruments. Well, some of them could hit the right notes. To play the MC, Mendes cast Alan Cumming, a young Scottish actor whose comedy act Mendes had enjoyed. Can you sing? Mendes asked him. Yeah, Cumming said. Mendes threw ideas at him, and he was open to everything. Just before the first preview, Mendes suggested he come out during the intermission and chat up the audience, maybe dance with a woman. Mendes, frantic before the preview, never got around to giving Cumming any more direction than that. No matter. Cumming sauntered on stage as people were settling back at their tables, picked out a man in the crowd, and started dancing with him. "Watch your hands," he said. "I lead." Cumming's MC was impish, fun, gleefully licentious. The audience loved him. "I have never had less to do with great performance in one of my shows than I had to do with Alan," Mendes says. When Joe Mastroff came to see the show in London, Mendes was nervous. He'd taken plenty of liberties with the script. Cliff, the narrator, was now openly gay. One night when Cliff kissed a male lover, a man in the audience shouted, "Rubbish!" And he made the MC a victim of the Nazis. In the final scene, Cumming, in a concentration camp uniform affixed with a yellow Star of David and a pink triangle, is jolted as if he's thrown himself into the electrified fence at Birkenau. "I should really be pissed with you," Mastroff told Mendes after the show, "but it works." Kander liked it too, though he was not happy that the actors didn't play his score all that well. Ebb hated it. "He wanted more professionalism," Mendes said, and he was not wrong. There was a dangerous edge of amateurishness about it. The Roundabout Theater Company brought cabaret to New York in 1998. Rob Marshall, who would go on to direct the movie Chicago, helped Mendes give the show some Broadway gloss while retaining its grittiness. The two young directors were challenging each other, pushing each other, Marshall remembers, to create something unique. Cumming reprised his role as the MC. He was on fire. Natasha Richardson, the daughter of Vanessa Redgrave and director Tony Richardson, played Sally Bowles. She was not on fire. She'd never been in a musical before, and when she sang, there was absolutely no sound coming out, Kander said. She beat herself up about her singing all the time, Mendes adds. There was a deep, self-critical aspect of Natasha that was instilled by her dad, a brilliant man, but extremely cutting. He once said to her out of nowhere, "We're going to have to do something about your chin, dear." As Mendes saw it, she always felt that she could never measure up to her parents. Kander went to work with her, and slowly a voice emerged. It was not a polished sound, Marshall says, but it was haunting, vulnerable. Still, Cumming was walking away with the show. At the first preview, when he took his bow, the audience roared. When Richardson took hers, they were polite. Mendes remembers going backstage and finding her in tears, but she persevered and through sheer force of will created a Sally Bowles that will break your heart, Mastroff told me the day before I saw that production in the spring of 1998. She did indeed. 11 years later, while learning how to ski on a bunny hill on Mont Tremblant, she fell down. She died of a head injury 2 days later. The revival of Cabaret won 4 Tony Awards, including one for Richardson as Best Actress in a Musical. It ran nearly 2,400 performances at the Roundabout Studio 54 and was revived again in 2014. And the money, 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 as the song goes, poured in. Once Mastroff, having already filed his taxes at the end of a lucrative cabaret year, went to the mailbox and opened a royalty check for $60,000. "What the hell am I supposed to do with this?" he snapped. Rebecca Frecknell grew up in Mendes' Donmar Warehouse production of Cabaret. The BBC filmed it, and when it aired, her father videotaped it. She watched it religiously. But when she came to direct her production, she had to put Mendes' version out of her mind. Mendes turned his little theater into a nightclub. Frecknell, working with the brilliant set and costume designer Tom Scutt, has upped the game. They have transformed the entire theater into a Weimar cabaret. You can stand in line at the stage door, waiting, you hope, to be let in. Once inside, you're served drinks while the Kit Kat Club girls dance and flirt with you. The show's logo is a geometric eye. Scutt sprinkles that motif throughout his sets and costumes. It's all part of the voyeurism, Scott explains. The sense of always being watched, always watching. Responsibility, culpability, implication, blame. Mendes's cabaret, like Fosse's, had a black and white aesthetic. Black fishnet stockings, black leather coats, a white face for the MC. Frecknell and Scott begin their show with bright colors, which slowly fade to gray as the walls close in on the characters. Color and individuality to grayness and homogeneity, Frecknell says. As the first woman to direct a major production of Cabaret, Frecknell has focused attention on the Kit Kat Club girls, Rosie, Fritzy, Frenchie, Lulu, and Texas. Often what I've seen in other productions is this homogenized group of pretty, white, skinny girls in their underwear, she insists. Her Kit Kat Club girls are multi-ethnic. Some are transgender. Through performance and costumes, they are no longer appendages of the MC, but vivid characters in their own right. Her boldest stroke has been to reinvent the MC. She and Redmayne have turned him into a force of malevolence. He's still sexy and seductive, but as the show goes on, he becomes a skeletal puppet master, manipulating the other characters to, in many cases, their doom. If Cummings' MC was in the end a Holocaust victim, Redmayne's is, in Frecknell's word, a perpetrator. Unwrapping a grilled cheese sandwich in his enormous Upper West Side townhouse, Kander says that his husband had recently asked him a pointed question. Did it ever occur to you that all of you guys who created Cabaret were Jewish? Not really, Kander replied. We were just trying to put on a show. Or as Masteroff once said, it was a job. It is a job that has endured. The producers of the Broadway revival certainly have faith in the show's staying power. They've spent $25 million on the production, a big chunk of it going to reconfigure the August Wilson Theater into the Kit Kat Club. Audience members will enter through an alleyway, be given a glass of schnapps, and can then enjoy a pre-show drink at a variety of lounges designed by Scott: the Pineapple Room, Red Bar, Green Bar, and Vault Bar. The show will be performed in the round, tables and chairs ringing the stage, and they'll be able to enjoy a bottle or two of top-flight champagne throughout the performance. This revival is certainly the most lavish cabaret in a long time, but there have been hundreds of others, less heralded productions over the years, with more on the way. A few months before Russia invaded Ukraine, Cabaret was running in Moscow. Last December, Concord Theatricals, which licenses the show, authorized a production at the Molodny Theater in Kyiv. And a request is in for a production in Israel, the first since the show was produced in Tel Aviv in 2014. The interesting thing about the piece is that it seems to change with the times, Kander said. Nothing about it seems to be written in stone except its narrative and its implications. And whenever someone tells him the show is more relevant than ever, Kander shakes his head and says, I know, isn't it awful? And now I'm going to go a little bit off script, off the Vanity Fair script. And since we just finished that article about Cabaret, I'm going to share the New York Times review of the opening by the Chief Times theater critic Jesse Green, which was published just 3 days ago. Cabaret Review. Headline: What good is screaming alone in your room? Eddie Redmayne and Gail Rankin star in a buzzy Broadway revival that rips the skin off the 1966 musical. Just east of its marquee, the August Wilson Theater abuts an alley you probably didn't notice when you were last there, perhaps to see Funny Girl, its previous tenant. Why would you? Where the trash goes is not usually part of the Broadway experience. but it is for the latest revival of Cabaret, which opened at the Wilson on Sunday. Audience members are herded into that alley, past the garbage, down some halls, up some stairs, and through a fringed curtain to a dimly lit lounge. There's a separate entrance for those with mobility issues. Along the way, greeters offer free shots of cherry schnapps that taste, I'm reliably told, like cough syrup cut with paint thinner. Too often, I thought the same of the show itself. But the show comes later. First, starting 75 minutes before, you can experience the ambiance of the various bars that constitute the so-called Kit Kat Club, branded in honor of the fictional Berlin Cabaret, where much of the musical takes place. Also meant to get you in the mood for a story set mostly in 1930, on the edge of economic and spiritual disaster, are some moody George Grosz-like paintings commissioned from Jonathan Lyndon Chase. One is called Dancing, Holiday Before Doom. The $9 thimbleful of potato chips is presumably a nod to the period's hyperinflation. This all seems like throat-clearing to me, as did the complete reconfiguration of the auditorium itself, which is now arranged like a large supper club or a small stadium. The scenic costume and theater design are the jaw-dropping work of Tom Scutt. The only relevant purpose I could see for this conceptual doodling, well carried out, however well carried out, is to give the fifth Broadway incarnation of the 1966 show a distinctive profile. And it certainly does that. The problem for me is that Cabaret has a distinctive profile already. The extreme one here, offered here, frequently defaces it. Let me quickly add that Rebecca Frecknell's production, first seen in London, has many fine and entertaining moments. Some feature its West End star Eddie Redmayne as the macabre MC of the Kit Kat Club and quite likely your nightmares. Some come from its New York cast, including Gail Rankin as the decadent would-be chanteuse Sally Bowles, and Bebe Neuwirth and Steve Skybell, dignified and wrenching as an older couple. Others arrive from Frecknell's staging itself, which is spectacular, when in an additive mood, illuminating the classic score by John Kander and Freb Ed, and the amazingly sturdy book by Joe Masteroff. But too often, a misguided attempt to resuscitate the show breaks its ribs. The conception of Sally is especially alarming. As written and as introduced in the play, the stories the musical is based on, she is a creature of blithe insouciance, if not talent, an English good-time gal flitting from brute to brute in Berlin while hoping to become a star. Her first number, Don't Tell Mama, is a lively Charleston with winking lyrics. You can tell my brother, that ain't grim, 'cause if he squeals on me, I'll squeal on him. Lyrics that make the Kit Kat Club audience, and the Broadway one too, complicit in her naughtiness. Instead, Frecknell gives us a Sally made up to look like she's recently been assaulted or released from an asylum, who dances like a wounded bird, stretches each syllable to the breaking point, and shrieks the song instead of singing it. If Rankin doesn't sound good in that number or later in Mein Herr, interpolated from the 1972 film, she's not trying to. Like the cough syrup paint thinner concoction, she's meant to be taken medicinally and poisonously in this production, projecting instead of concealing Sally's turmoil. That's Inside Out. The point of Sally and of Cabaret is, more generally, to dramatize the danger of disengagement from reality, not to fetishize it. The gut's first problem also distorts Redmayne's MC, but at least that character was always intended as allegorical. He is the host to anything, the amoral shapeshifter becoming whatever he must to get by. Here, he begins as a kind of marionette in a leather skirt and tiny party hat, hiccuping his way through Willkommen. Later, he effectively incarnates himself as a creepy clown, an undead skeleton, Sally's twin, and a glossy Nazi. Having seen Frecknell's riveting production of Sanctuary City, a play about undocumented immigrants by Martina Mayock, I am not surprised that her cabaret finds a surer footing in the book or dramatic scenes. These are the ones that take place in the real Berlin, not the metaphorical one of the Kit Kat Club. She is extraordinarily good when she starts with the naturalistic surface of behavior, letting the mise-en-scene and the lighting, which is excellent by Isabella Boyd, suggest the rest. And naturalism is what you find at the boarding house run by Fräulein Schneider, Bibi Neuwirth, a woman who has learned to keep her nose down to keep safe. Her tenants included Jewish fruitier Hirsch Scholz, Stephen Skybell, a prostitute, Fräulein Kost, and Clifford Bradshaw, an American writer come to Berlin in search of inspiration. Soon, Sally shows up to provide it, having talked her way into Cliff's life in bed, despite being little more than a stranger. Also, despite Cliff's romantic ambivalence. Over the years, the character has had his sexuality revamped more times than a clownfish. The Schneider-Schultz romance is sweet and sad. Neither character is called upon to shriek. And Rankin excels in Sally's scenes with Cliff, her wry, frank, and hopeful personality back in place. The songs that emerge from the boarding house dramas are not ransacked as psychiatric case studies, but are rather given room to let comment proceed naturally from real entertainment. Rankin's, maybe this time, with no slathered-on histrionics, is riveting. It turns out she can properly sing. The interface between naturalism and expressionism does make for some weird moments. Herr Schultz, courtly in a top coat, must hug Sally goodbye in her bra. But letting the styles mix also brings out the production's most haunting imagery. The intrusion of the Nazi threat into the story is especially well handled. First, a gloriously sung and thus chilling version of Tomorrow Belongs to Me, then the swastika, and then, well, I don't want to give away how Frecknell stages the scene in which Schultz's fruit shop is vandalized. That so many of these moments arise from faithful attention to the original material should be no surprise. Cabaret hasn't lasted this long for nothing. Created at the tail end of Broadway's golden age, it benefited from a tradition of meticulous craftsmanship that preceded it, while anticipating the era of conceptual stagings that followed. All this is baked into the book, and especially the score, which I trust I admire not merely because I worked on a Kander and Ebb show 40 years ago. That the lyrics rhyme perfectly is a given with Ebb. More importantly, they're always the right words to rhyme. Listen in the title song for the wildly spaced triplet of room, broom, and tomb. And Kander's music, remixing period jazz, Kurt Weill, and Broadway exuberance, never oversteps the milieu or outpaces the characters, even as it pushes them toward their full and sometimes manic expression. When this new cabaret follows that template, it achieves more than a buzz of chic architecture and louche dancing. Seducing us and then repelling us in that order, it dramatizes why we flock to such things in the first place, whether at the Kit Kat Club or the August Wilson Theater. We hope, at our risk, to forget that outside, life is disappointing, as the MC tells us. We want to unsee the trash. So that's a bit of a mixed review, I would say, for the new production of Cabaret by Jesse Green. And yet it does sound interesting, as do many of these other productions. Well, thanks so much for listening to Vanity Fair today and a bit of the New York Times. This is Susan Durfee for CABVI's Radio Reading Services. Until next time.